and our leadership would be around much longer, and hence at last he declared a war on our country. All the member states participating in the United Nations and the whole world should clearly remember that it was the U.S. who first declared war on our country.
That's North Korea's foreign minister speaking through his interpreter to reporters in New York today. He was reacting to a tweet over the weekend in which President Donald Trump wrote, quote, "Just heard foreign minister of North Korea speak at UN. If he echoes thoughts of Little Rocket Man, they won't be around much longer." Barbara Demick is national reporter for the LA Times and its former Korea and Beijing bureau chief. She joins us now. Hi.
Hello.
Well, North Korea's foreign minister also said the U.S. declaration of war, as he calls it, gives North Korea the right to shoot down U.S. jets even outside its own airspace. Would that be military jets or all jets? What was he talking about?
Well, I think he was talking about the type of overflights that took place on the weekend when U.S. planes from Guam flew north of the DMZ outside North Korean airspace, but very close, to send a message. And I think that's kind of what set the North Koreans off.
You've been watching and reporting on North Korea for a very long time. Have you ever seen the U.S. and the North Korean regime this close to conflict?
I've seen them, the rhetoric, very high on both times. You know, certainly it was during the George W. Bush administration. I would say not this high, because the difference is even under the Bush administration, there was always sort of a stock line thrown in there from the White House that, you know, if North Korea wants to join the family of nations and denuclearize, we will welcome them. And in this case, I don't see any offer on hand from the Trump administration. They've been really pushing the North Koreans into a corner, and that I have not seen before.
Okay, and what happens when the North Koreans are pushed into a corner?
Well, you know, we'll see, but, you know, I think it's quite alarming to those of us who watch North Korea, because it's, you know, our president, President Trump, is kind of daring the North Koreans to do their thing. And, you know, you have a very young, impetuous leader in North Korea. And, you know, President Trump seems to be pushing him in a direction that, you know, I think some people don't want. You know, again, you know, sort of one of the principles of war is that you always give your enemy an out so that people don't get hurt. And I don't see any offer to the North Koreans to back down.
So what are the chances that there could be a conventional military war?
You know, I wrote a story about this saying it's 50-50. I don't know that it's that high. I couldn't say. But, you know, certainly we're, you know, in very dangerous territory.
50-50. That's what experts are telling you?
Some people feel it could be 50-50.
Uh-huh.
I don't know.
Right.
Or conventional war.
And then what happens, what are the chances they think that perhaps nuclear weapons could be used?
You know, the problem with the North Koreans is they're weak. This is one of these sayings that nuclear weapons are the weapons of the weak because they can't compete on a conventional battlefield.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think there's a fear that the North Koreans would be inclined to reach for the nuclear option fairly early if they think that their regime is going down.
And by nuclear option, that would mean sending a nuclear missile into where, Guam or South Korea or what?
You know, for all their advances, which are quite impressive, I don't know that they're able to mount a nuclear warhead on a missile. There's a lot of issues, technical issues about atmosphere, entry, reentry. You know, they don't seem to be there yet, but there's, you know, it would be a possibility of smuggling a nuclear weapon into a container port, putting a weapon on an airplane. You know, it doesn't take a very sophisticated nuclear weapon to cause great damage, as we saw in Hiroshima a very long time ago. So I think they could do something unpleasant, even if they cannot mount it on a missile and hit the west coast of the United States, as they've warned.
Well, the accepted wisdom about Kim Jong-un and his pursuit of a nuclear weapons program is that he doesn't want to end up like Muammar Gaddafi did in Libya, gave up his nuclear ambitions, and then look where it got him. So in a sense, does this ensure a level of deterrence?
Well, I think it might under another U.S. administration. I think most North Korea watchers who try to, you know, channel the feelings of the North Koreans understand what Kim Jong-un is doing. I think that's why very few think that he'll give up the nuclear weapons. You know, he has a fear of being attacked and deposed. He saw what happened to Saddam Hussein and, you know, even more so Gaddafi. I think he thinks it's his insurance policy. I don't think he's ever had any intention of attacking the U.S. first, but again, this war of words could precipitate something.
And what are the Chinese saying about this war of words?
Well, the Chinese are just, you know, trying to get everybody to calm down. I think they have been sufficiently scared of the Trump administration that they're being a bit more proactive in cutting off oil sales to North Korea. But the Chinese and the Russians have both been saying, you know, sort of grow up, sit down, don't do this.
Well, if war, a conventional war, were to break out, would the Chinese get involved militarily on the North Korean side?
The Chinese have said that if North Korea strikes first, if North Korea does something to attack the U.S. or U.S. bases, they would not help North Korea. It's not, you know, friends at, you know, no matter what behavior. Mm-hmm. If the U.S. Tried either a preventative or a preemptive strike, the Chinese might get involved. I don't know that they would send their troops swarming across the Yalu River, like happened in 1950, but I don't think they would stand by idly. And I think, you know, I think a lot of people are sort of waiting for the Chinese to come up with some great peace initiative right now to get everybody to calm down.
Thanks so much, Barbara.
Thank you.
That's Barbara Demick, national reporter for the Los Angeles Times and author of the book Nothing to Envy: Ordinary Lives in North Korea. Well, speaking of North Korea, it is now part of the latest version of President Trump's travel ban. The new order unveiled yesterday indefinitely bans nearly all travel from seven countries. Most are majority Muslim and were included in earlier versions of Trump's ban. But there are some changes. In addition to North Korea, Chad is on the list now. Sudan was dropped. Travelers from Iraq and some from Venezuela will face tighter restrictions. In response to the revised order, the Supreme Court today canceled a planned hearing on the current version of Trump's travel ban. Jessica Levinson is here to sort all of this out for us on a legal basis. She is a law professor at Loyola Law School, and she joins us every Monday. Okay, so a lot to wade through here. First of all, the Supreme Court canceling these arguments. So what does that mean?
Or postponing. It's not over till it's over. Well, what it means is that there was the travel ban that they were going to review, which is actually the second travel ban. And now there's this new indefinite travel ban, which is a little bit more stringent. It drops some countries. It adds some countries. And the question is, and the question, frankly, was even before this travel ban, is that travel ban they were going to review moot? Because it expired yesterday. And I think that the current Supreme Court is going to be really excited to not hear this case.
And so send it back to the lower courts and say, you figure it out?
Well, they have a couple of options. The Trump administration, the Solicitor General, last night asked the Supreme Court and said, you know what, I really think we should file new briefs on October 5th to talk about how the new travel ban will affect the travel ban that you're looking at. And the court said basically yes to that. By October 5th, we need new briefs to tell us whether or not there's still a live case or controversy and how the new travel ban impacts the one that was under review. So they could say, thank you so much for your briefs, and we'd like to hear this by Thanksgiving, by Christmas, by Valentine's Day. Or they could say, this has been wonderful. Thank you for your time. We're going to send you back to the lower courts to make a determination about the new travel ban, which, again, affects additional countries and affects them in different ways. So I think they absolutely could say with a straight face, this should work its way through the lower courts. This should work its way through the judicial system and then come back to us on a normal appeal.
Okay. So meanwhile, this is supposed to go into effect on October 18th. So pretty soon. And as I said, seven countries affected, six of which are Muslim majority. So let's talk about this constitutional case, because that was the main argument on the part of the people who didn't like the ban, was that, well, this is discriminatory. So now that he has added North Korea, which is not Muslim, and then some Venezuelans, these are officials who are not, some government officials who are not allowed to come to the country, does that then ease these, you know, these concerns about it being discriminatory?
Well, yes and no. Doesn't everybody love that answer? In a certain sense, this is going to be harder to challenge. This looks more constitutional. It was the result of a much deeper process. The Department of Homeland Security issued a memo and said, for these reasons, these are the countries that we need to prohibit the issuance of visas. And so there's a lot more there than, you know, potentially Steve Bannon just saying, here are some countries, they're Muslim majority, and we think we should temporarily prohibit travel. Now, so supporters of President Trump are going to say the chief executive has broad authority when it comes to immigration and security. He's gone through a vetting process. He's listened to the Department of Homeland Security. And look, there's even two countries that are not Muslim majority countries. So this can't be a Muslim ban. Critics of the ban have said, look, listen to candidate Trump, listen to President Trump, listen to his surrogates. This has always been about prohibiting Muslims from coming into the country. And the fact, you know, there weren't a lot of people coming from North Korea to begin with. Travel was basically frozen. If you look at North Korea and people who are affiliated with the government of Venezuela, it's not like they were flooding into our country. And this could look like, for lack of a better way of describing it, Muslim countries and countries that we don't really love so much. Mm-hmm. So the question is whether a judge will say, you know what, you can tack on two additional countries, but it's still a Muslim ban, or whether a judge will say the president has a lot of authority in this area. It's about national security, and this looks a lot more constitutional.
Or it's about imposing sanctions for a country that's behaving in a way we don't like, which, of course, they can do.
And it can be a way of trying to incentivize them to, for instance, change their vetting process. You know, using immigration policy to impose sanctions is kind of a tricky thing, which isn't exactly the constitutional question as to whether or not this is a ban on Muslims. And again, that is the crux of the issue, because we don't get to target a certain religion. If there are legitimate security reasons and it just so happens that their concerns focus on Muslim majority countries, that's okay, but not because they're Muslim majority countries.
Okay, so the arguments, they need to be in by October 5th?
The new briefs need to be in by October 5th, and then my guess is that there is going to be a majority of the court that is so excited to never hear oral arguments on this. And if they do, I have a strong suspicion that Chief Justice John Roberts is going to say, this looks like it's moot. Folks, doesn't it look like it's moot? Hold my hands and say the word moot together. I do not think the Supreme Court wants to rule on the constitutionality. The question is, those lower court decisions, the Fourth Circuit, the Ninth Circuit, all the court decisions that prohibited the travel ban from going into effect, what happens to those? Do those cases get wiped out? Are they still on the books? The Trump administration, surprisingly, not so excited for them to stay on the books. So lots of unanswered questions.
Okay. Well, thank you for trying to answer them anyway.
I do my best. Thank you.
Jessica Levinson, law professor at Loyola Law School. Coming up on the show, how California might be opening the door to harsh disciplinary policies for black boys in school with its new sexual assault bill. That story is next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos has rescinded Obama-era policies on sexual assault at colleges and universities. The new guidelines allow schools to invoke a stricter standard for whether an assault took place. Well, now California is pushing back, or it's trying to. A bill awaiting Governor Jerry Brown's signature would keep the Obama standards and expand them to high schools and elementary schools. That is a bad idea, according to University of San Francisco law professor Lara Bazelon. She says there could be terrible consequences, especially for black boys. And she joins us now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, tell us more about this bill. Why did California want to extend these sexual assault policies to young students, kindergartners even?
California is standing up as a beacon against what it sees as various rollbacks and abuses by the Trump administration, environmentally, sanctuary city-wise, and in other ways. And this bill was part of a package of pushback legislation. Why it expanded to children so young is not clear to me. The Obama guidelines, as written, the 2011 guidelines, did technically apply to secondary school children whose schools received federal funding, but it was never the focus of the guidelines to crack down on kids. And the controversy that grew out of it was really how they were applied on college and university campuses. Mm-hmm. But California determined that sexual harassment and sexual violence were a pervasive problem in kindergarten, elementary, and secondary schools, and so wrote this law very broadly.
So let's say this passes, or it did pass already. Let's say Governor Brown signs it and it becomes law. What do you envision happening? What is the worst-case scenario in your mind?
The worst-case scenario in my mind is that, like all heavy-handed disciplinary policies, it's going to fall disproportionately upon children of color. And there are a number of reasons for that, all of which are unfortunate. One is that we have a very shameful history in our country of having this very incendiary relationship between how we see black males and sexuality, and we're more likely to punish them and see them as sexually violent. So that's the first problem. The second problem is that children whose parents are going to have the means to fight back against heavy-handed disciplinary policies often tend to be white and privileged. And so if you're not either of those things and you don't have the means to, for example, hire a lawyer or meaningfully challenge what's happening to your child is more likely to be suspended or expelled. And then there's just the broader history of what we know to be the way discipline is carried out by school administrators in California, regardless of what the disciplinary charge is. And in case after case, it's been shown that overwhelmingly and disproportionately, children of color are singled out.
Well, what about the opposite? The fact that for a very long time, including up to the present day, victims of sexual assault are routinely dismissed and their charges are not taken seriously.
That is the other side, and it's a powerful other side. And what I would say in response is, first of all, to acknowledge that sexual assault on campuses and in universities is a pervasive problem, and it does cause trauma and, in some cases, lifelong damage. And it is important to address that and to have victims feel that they are heard. At the same time, what happened under the Obama guidelines in 2011 was, in some respects, an overcorrection, where the process to adjudicate those claims was set up in a way that wasn't providing due process to the other side. Having the standard be as low as it is, which is basically 50% plus a hair for a finding of responsibility, is so low that these colleges and universities, which are already under pressure to make findings because they were told if they didn't get tougher, they would come under federal investigation and possibly lose their federal funding, were geared toward making these findings.
So do you think Betsy DeVos was right in rescinding these Obama-era rules?
This is a tricky question to answer because the problem with advocating for due process and advocating for the accused is that people say that you are a Trump supporter and a Betsy DeVos supporter, and that then leads to accusations that you are a rape apologist and many of the other things that have been said about me and about other people who are Democrats and feminists who have said the right thing to do is to take a hard look at these guidelines and revise them. So the short answer is I do think it was right to take a hard look, to ask for notice and comment, to revise them and to go forward in that way. But I think the problem is it's very hard to have a reasoned debate about it because the issue has become so politicized.
Hmm. Okay, so this bill you think is a bad idea and it now awaits the governor's signature. What would you rather see? What would you rather see in a bill like this that would maybe be, I don't know, a middle ground between the two?
Yeah, it's interesting. And to be honest, I don't see any revisions that could save this bill. What I would like to see are policies that are crafted very carefully toward due process for both sides and also that allow for the possibility, if both parties voluntarily agree, to some other form of resolving the issue, whether that is mediation or restorative justice. And again, I want to emphasize that I think both parties would need to agree to that, and it would depend very much on the specific nature of the allegation. But to not even consider alternative measures to harsh disciplinary measures seems very misguided to me.
So this would be handled by the schools, this discipline. Isn't that better than being handled by the criminal justice system?
Yes. Generally speaking, it is. I mean, there are a couple of things to say about that. Many cases involving sexual assault never see the inside of a courtroom, and that's because prosecutors can't prove those cases beyond a reasonable doubt. There just isn't the evidence for that. And quite often, the person who claims to have been assaulted, the victim, doesn't want to go through the criminal justice process, which is very adversarial and can be quite harsh. So having some measure of justice for victims and survivors of sexual assault, even if it's within a school and the only sanction is discipline, seems to me to be important. On the other hand, I don't think that we should underplay the consequences of these kinds of proceedings. What people often say is, well, it's just a suspension or it's just a expulsion. It's not as if these children are going to jail or going to prison. And what I would say is what Professor Janet Holly of Harvard has said, which is you need to consider when you separate a child from his education, that's the end of a life plan.
Hmm. Yeah, very difficult to get into another school, very difficult to get back on track after you've been expelled. And so, you know, you've raised the specter of kindergartners being, adjudicated for committing some kind of assault if they tried to kiss a girl on the playground. Is that really going to happen? I mean, it seems ludicrous on the face of it.
It does seem ludicrous on the face of it. But the problem is what we've seen in the context of universities and colleges are accusations that were found to be true in situations that just cry out as completely unjust and almost as ridiculous as the example that you just cited. So, for example, a football kicker at USC was just expelled based on allegations that he sexually assaulted his girlfriend. This case is now pending in court. He's challenging the expulsion in court. And the person he allegedly assaulted, his girlfriend, says that nothing untoward happened. And then, in fact, when she tried to say that, what the USC Title IX investigators told her was that she had all of the symptoms of a battered woman and she was just denying the truth of what had happened. And what she says in the sworn statement is the people that she feels harassed her and made her miserable and wrecked her life were actually the Title IX investigators from the school. That's not really, unfortunately, a unique example. There are other examples of those kinds of adjudications that have just gone so utterly awry. And I think that is why I don't think that it's outside of the realm of possibility for the examples that I bring up to actually happen in real life. When you have administrators who are incentivized to make these findings, either because they're going to lose funding or they're going to get investigated, or this is a state law that is binding on them, and they are not well trained, and they are under pressure, you end up with outcomes that are so unjust that you wouldn't believe it.
Well, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's Laura Bazelon. She's an associate professor of law and the director of the Criminal, Juvenile Justice and Racial Justice Clinical Programs at the University of San Francisco School of Law. Coming up, the president's campaign against NFL players who protest during the national anthem and how that's playing on the field.
We don't exist just as football players. We don't exist just as workers. We don't exist just to make money for owners and others. We don't exist just for fun and pleasure of fans, but we're people.
Also, actor Rob Reiner talks about his new Russia project. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand.
As a man, as a father, as an African-American man, as somebody in the NFL, as one of those sons of bitches, you know, like, yeah, I took it personally, but at the same time, like I said in my Twitter post, it's bigger than me, man. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's bigger than me. I got a daughter. She's going to have to live in this world. You know what I'm saying? And I'm going to do whatever I got to do to make sure, you know, she can look at my dad, look at her dad and be like, hey, you did something. You tried to make a change. You feel me?
Miami Dolphins safety Michael Thomas speaking yesterday about his protest and President Trump's comments on football and the national anthem. Trump lashed out at players who knee or sit, calling them a profanity and saying they should be fired. At the White House today, Press Secretary Sarah Huckabee Sanders had this response.
It's always appropriate for the president of this country to promote our flag, to promote our national anthem, and ask people to respect it.
To promote the
Jeff,
First Amendment.
Peter, I've answered your question.
Well, David J. Leonard knows a lot about this topic. He teaches at Washington State University, and he's the author of the book Playing While White, Privilege and Power on and Off the Field. Welcome.
Thank you. Thanks for having me so much.
Well, it's great to have you. So you write and think a lot about race and sports. What's your take on what's been happening over the weekend and today?
Well, I mean, I think one of the key elements is that the protests are obviously over a year old, and that seems to be one of the elements that have been lost in the discussion is why Colin Kaepernick initially kneeled in protest to the continued issue of systemic racism and police violence.
And talk a little bit, if you will, about activism with regards to the NFL, because unlike the NBA, the NFL has, or at least the players, haven't taken strong political stances as a matter of course. So can you talk about why now the NFL is becoming a little more political?
Well, I think there's a couple elements. I mean, when you look at the history of the NFL and its relationship with the military, when you look at the connection between many owners and the Trump administration, you can see that it's embraced a particular type of politics that is antithetical to racial justice. And I think Colin Kaepernick seized upon this platform irrespective of that resistance and kneeled in protest. And so this weekend when the president made his remarks, which were not new regarding Colin Kaepernick, and did so in such a pointed way using profanity, that has inspired obviously over 100 individuals to join force. Mm-hmm. And I think it was in many ways a wake-up call for many to use their voice, to use their bodies, to say that we don't exist just as football players. We don't exist just as workers. We don't exist just to make money for owners and others. We don't exist just for fun and pleasure of fans, but we're people, and we have voices, and we have pain, and we have views about our current political moment, and many have seized upon that.
What is not getting as much attention, but some other comments the president made in that speech, was he taking issue with new rules that aim to prevent violence on the field, the 15-yard penalty rule for excessive violence. And he said that that was a bad idea and was making the game boring. What do you make of that?
Well, I actually think the two comments are connected because both are saying that your livelihood, your future, your needs as players, as a primarily African-American league, don't matter. And so the lack of regard for the health of players on the field and the lack of regard for the health and happiness and justice of players and their families and their friends and their loved ones and their communities off the field are very much interconnected. And so I think it's important for us to talk about the protest that Colin Kaepernick started, asking America, do Black Lives Matter off the field? Do Black Lives Matter whether scoring touchdowns or not? And what President Trump's remarks reminded us is that this question needs to be asked about on the field. Do Black Lives Matter on the field? Is their safety, do their long-term health and happiness, does that matter? Or does ultimately the profit and the popularity of football take precedence over these important questions?
Are you surprised that the owners came out against what the president said, including Bob Kraft of the Patriots, who financially supported the president's campaign?
I'm not, especially because of how they did come out. You know, they didn't come out in support of Colin Kaepernick's protest in terms of the specific issues. They didn't come out and say, you know, we're going to look into why Colin Kaepernick doesn't have a job. They didn't come out and say anything regarding his comments about CTE and the status of the game. They came out and in many regards condemned the divisiveness, condemned the intrusion of politics onto the sporting field. And I think that should give us pause because politics are central to the sporting field, whether we're talking about race or gender or militarism or the fact that the national anthem is played before the game or that we have flyovers from planes. Politics are front and center. So I think it became a way for owners to create this artificial distance from these comments, to create this narrative that they're with players, when in many regards we see daily examples that demonstrate otherwise.
Do you think there'll be pressure now, even more pressure, to hire Colin Kaepernick for someone to do that?
Yes, but I don't know if that will have an effect. That there's so many built-in narratives that have developed in the last year, whether it be about his play or about his desire to play or about other quarterbacks fitting in better, that these explanations will continue to be cited in a way to dismiss those claims and those criticisms and then those protests. And then at the same time, because the current discussions are more and more about the flag and the national anthem and then the president, that I think both Colin Kaepernick's stance and what he was standing for and the issues at hand, as well as his future, is getting lost in the shuffle.
Hmm. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That's David J. Leonard. He teaches at Washington State University, and he's author of the book Playing While White, Privilege and Power on and Off the Field. From politics and sports to politics and entertainment now, actor and director Rob Reiner has launched a new group. It's called the Committee to Investigate Russia.
We have been attacked. We are at war. Imagine this movie script. A former KGB spy, angry at the collapse of his motherland,
That's Morgan Freeman narrating a video on the group's website. Reiner's committee is in the early stages of getting organized. It's built timelines and posted articles online, but he says it'll do much more to call attention to what he calls the attack on American democracy.
Somebody dropped an atom bomb on us, or, you know, we saw like what happened at 9/11 or Pearl Harbor. We'd all react to it and know what we need to do, and we'd come together as a country. But since this is so surreptitious and insidious, we don't understand what's happened, you know, and this is the first time we haven't seen a president basically call on America to come together and say, you know, this is something we need to focus on here. We need, this is our national security that's at stake here.
Okay. So when you go to your site, when someone wants to find out more, basically what you've done is aggregated news articles, correct?
Right, right.
So you're not doing independent investigations yourself.
No, but they will be. I mean, we don't have subpoena power. We don't have the capacity to do that kind of thing. But ultimately, we're gonna, you know, we're just started. We just started, you know, a couple of days ago. But what we're going to go through is, number one, put together a citizens commission, a citizens committee. If the Congress is not willing to do it, we'll put together a blue ribbon panel of citizens and have some discussions and make some recommendations that can be either accepted or not.
So you're not satisfied that in the House and the Senate, with the intelligence committees investigating this and also Robert Mueller, that they will get to the bottom of it?
Well, they will. They will. But then at some point, you need to have a commission that will make real recommendations as to what needs to happen in order to make yourself secure. I mean, I trust that Robert Mueller, you know, he has a tremendous amount of integrity on from both sides of the aisle. I trust that he will, he will do his investigation and come up with his conclusions. But, you know, he's looking for crimes. If there are no crimes committed, then he can't propose a prosecution. And if he finds collusion, that's not a crime. So he has to just, you know, close the books on that. So there's all kinds of things that we need to know about as a society in order to make ourselves safe. And by the way, this has nothing to do with Donald Trump. Donald Trump is going to be long gone after we are still going to be wrestling with how do we secure ourselves in a modern world with new technology and the portent of cyber warfare.
What do you mean it has nothing to do with Donald Trump? I mean,
it doesn't. It doesn't. Donald Trump happens to be the guy who got elected.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're not trying to investigate Donald Trump. I mean, this is about what the Russians did to us.
And there has been a little bit of criticism from both the right and the left about your committee in that it does not have people on it who are experts on Russia, dedicated experts on Russia.
Well, we do have. I mean, I don't know if you know Evelyn Farkas, but she's a Russian expert. We have a few others that are there. I mean, we didn't list every name, but you know, I think now that we've gotten that pushback, you'll see a whole bunch of other names. The thing that's bad is that you got Rob Reiner. People have a bad view because, you know, I'm supposedly a Hollywood guy or whatever. But if they looked into anything that I've done in my life, they'll see that I worked in government for 7 years. I held positions in government. I've done a lot of things that have nothing to do with show business and have to be something else that I do. But, you know, they it's an easy one to say, it's a Hollywood guy, you know, Morgan Freeman, they can do all that.
Well, you did have Morgan Freeman do the video.
But they don't attack the truth of what's being said there.
Right.
If you notice. They, nobody's saying, hey, that's not right. You know, nobody says that.
Yeah. What was the initial spark for this? What made you think this needs to happen?
I'll tell you what the initial spark was. Every time our country has been attacked in some manner, we as a country have always come together. You know, that cliche thing that you always hear, politics ends at the water's edge. Well, it didn't end at the water's edge. This happened to us. And it stayed divided. And I thought, this is crazy. I mean, when, like we said, Pearl Harbor, 9/11, it unifies us. All of a sudden, we're not unified. One of the reasons we don't get unified is you got the man at the top who says it's all a hoax. It didn't happen. And so that minimizes what has happened here. And it shows a tremendous lack of awareness of what actually happened here. So that got me scared. I got scared, to be honest with you. And I said, let's do something, get a bipartisan group of people. And I talked mostly to Republicans. I've talked to many, many Republicans about this, and every single one of them said, thank God you're doing this. Thank God you're doing this, because for whatever reasons, you know, the electeds, the Republican electeds, don't have the guts or the courage to stand up and say what they know is true. But you've got a lot of very prominent Republicans who are speaking out, you know, and Max Boot is one, and David Frum and Charlie Sykes, and I've talked with George Will and Charles Krauthammer, and the list goes on. I mean, everybody I've talked to said, yeah, I think this is a good thing that you're trying to do here. So, it's unfortunate, you know, that I'm a famous person, and they want to tar it with me.
Well,
but
right,
That's why I went on the air with David Frum.
But let me ask you about that, because David Frum is a never Trumper. I mean, the Republicans you listed
matter.
There
it's
were never Trumpers.
Trump. It's not about Trump.
No, but everything is seen through that lens or through a partisan lens,
well,
as you
I mean,
well
fine.
Know.
And that's the problem. You just hit on the problem. You see things on through a partisan lens, even though this isn't partisan. How could it be partisan?
Well, I guess what I'm wondering is how do you cut through that and get people who are supporters of Donald Trump to go on your website and consider the articles
well,
there
I,
and read
I,
them
I don't know. I'm trying. I'm trying. You know, I'm trying to do what I can do. He once said that I could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue. I'll never lose any votes. So I don't know how to reach those guys. I'm trying. I'm trying. I'm trying to appeal to people's patriotism and say it doesn't matter whether it's Donald Trump or Hillary Clinton. It doesn't matter. We have been attacked, and we have to understand that in order to figure out how to protect ourselves in the future.
Well, Rob Reiner, thanks so much. It's been a pleasure speaking
with
you.
Thanks for letting me spew.
Of course, anytime. Okay. Rob Reiner, he's
right.
A filmmaker, an actor, a political activist, and he has started a new website. It's called The Committee to Investigate Russia. Coming up, should we say goodbye to the venerable fourth grade California Mission Project? New state guidelines say, yeah, maybe. That's next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Building a mission in elementary school has become a rite of passage for any kid growing up in California. Fourth graders are assigned a mission, and usually they have to make a replica of it from scratch, complete with arches, bell towers, and fountains. They can get creative and use sugar cubes or Legos. But for the uninspired or for the busy parent, there are online stores that sell ready-made mission kits. All of that might be coming to an end this year. The State Board of Education has adopted a new framework that asks teachers to re-examine the mission-building lesson plan. Peggy Slattery is with us now to talk about her memories of watching her son, who is now 36, do the project. Hi, Peggy.
Hi, Madeline.
So he's 36 and you still remember it?
I do, because it was a story that I would relay because it was sort of comical.
So what happened?
Well, both my husband and I are native New Yorkers, but we've been here for 39 years. So when Sean was in fourth grade, the early 90s, I guess it was, small school, Silver Lake, and he was doing this project, you know, the Mission Project. So it was a group project, and we didn't know anything about the California Mission Project, the parents. And so they did it, and the boys would come over after school. There were three of them, and they just did it and really didn't ask our help at all, except for asking us at one point. They asked me if they could, if I had any material that they could cover their floor of their mission with. And the only material I had was sort of this leopard velour kind of stretchy, really, really, just really awesome, crappy stuff, right? And so they took that and they did that and they designed their house. When finished, or almost finished, my husband and I commented, it looked like a burned out building from the Bronx. It was just, it was clay, and they barely molded the pieces, and we didn't interfere. We had no idea what the competition would be, that it would be so, you know, some of the other pieces elaborate. And so the story is that when my husband took the boys that day, he took his truck so they could carry it with them, and as they were getting out with the leopard velour flooring and this crooked, burnt out building, one of the pieces fell off, and one of the kids just took the gum that was out of his mouth and he stuck it in and they put it back together. And because I didn't have I didn't go with them that day, I never got to see the project until open school night when we both went. And I have to tell you, Madeline, it was hilarious. I mean,
were you mortified?
No. I'll tell you what, I wasn't mortified, because when I looked at the other pieces, now this is just me, maybe, or my husband and I, but the other pieces, some of them were exquisite. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking before kits or anything. They had little chapel bells, and they had things, and there was this thing that was really, I think, a labor of love and independence for these boys.
And how much did he actually learn about the history of the missions?
You know, I don't know how much he learned. He's a really good student. He became a mathematician. So I don't know how much he learned about the missions. But what I will say to you, what I think the moral of this, of the story was that for our son, he part of the process was walking back from school, the first time he ever was able to walk home from school alone with his friends to do the project. And that's what he has told us. He says, hey, that was the best thing. That's what he remembers of the Mission Project.
Uh-huh. Okay, so it was a lesson in independence.
I think so. For him, it was definitely that lesson. And, you know, I don't know. He's in Italy right now, looking at probably a lot of churches and bells and things like that on vacation.
And presumably none have leopard velour in them. Peggy, thank you so much for your memory.
You are so welcome.
Bye. Lisa Hutton is here now. She helped design the new education framework. She's a history expert at Cal State Dominguez Hills and also a former fourth grade teacher herself. And Lisa, is that kind of story, is that one of the reasons why this is kind of going by the wayside? Because, well, it's just an arts and crafts project?
Well, I think that there are certain schools where it's a tradition and the families enjoy it. But I think it has a little bit more to do with questioning whether it's a real balanced project for the fourth grade students. So, you know, at this point, we would encourage fourth grade teachers to read the framework, to possibly think about making sure that they're including multiple perspectives. And so, you know, the mission buildings, which are beautiful and part of our history, were also, you know, they were responsible for the destruction of indigenous Californians. And I think it's important to look at the missions from that perspective as well.
Mm. Can you not do that as well as have a fun time making a mission with your parents or maybe watching your parent make it?
Certainly.
I
was a fourth grade teacher, and I think I've worked with a lot of fourth grade teachers. I think a lot of teachers have already discontinued the mission project. I never did it. It was one whole standard that reaches from indigenous California all the way through the California Rancho period. So I think many people just didn't see it as very valuable. A lot of times it was the parents buying the kit at Michael's or wherever they bought it. Other, I think, schools have made it where they look at daily life at the missions from more than one perspective, and that would be the kind of activity that the new framework would encourage.
All right. Lisa Hutton, thank you so much.
Sure.
And we also heard from Peggy Slattery. And we want to hear from you about your mission project memories at KCRW Press Play, Twitter, or Facebook. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.